Welcome to the Plain Label Podcast, Pod Shots. To another episode of Podshots. I'm your host, Eric Williams. For this episode, we are discussing the 1975 film Rollerball. Written by William Harrison, the film was directed by Norman Jewison and stars James Caan. Here to discuss the film with me is returning guest, Mr. Chris Niesman.
Howdy.
Before getting into our discussion, I would like to mention that this podcast is brought to you by the Deliberate Noise Network. Head over to deliberatenoise.com and check out some of the other shows that are over there. Okay, so drink roll call, as I will remind you once again that I stole from you directly. What are you drinking?
One of my go-to podcast drinks. It's seriously like 24 degrees outside or something ridiculous. I'm having a bourbon and ginger ale, which is usually one of my summer drinks, but gotta get the rest of the ginger ale finished off here before we get into the really cold weather.
Yeah, that's a smart move. That's what it is about in Nebraska as well. I was thinking, you know, old Jimmy Caan seems like a whiskey kind of a guy,
mm-hmm.
right? And I do have some Jameson and some Coke, and so I was debating going for that. But instead, I kind of pussied out and ran out of time. And so I'm going with from the Lagunitas Brewing Company, which is one of my favorite brewing companies. I'm going with a limited release from them called Little Something Extra Ale.
Nice.
Which is not the Little Something Something Ale.
So it's a little more than a Little Something Something.
Yeah, it's a little more. It is an 8.5%.
Whoa.
So it's a pretty heavy duty.
Nice.
Heavy duty guy. So
they just opened up a big brewing facility here in Chicago. The guy that started that is originally a Chicagoan. And so I think they're all of their East Coast and Midwest beer is going to be made here in Chicago.
I knew that, Mr. Niesman, because I was there about 3 weeks ago.
Oh, awesome. How was it?
It was good. It's not in the greatest part of town.
No.
My friend that lives in Chicago was like, this is not the place you want to take a wrong turn at late at night. but no, it was really good. It was really reasonable, and they had a ton of beer that is not available local, you know, in here in Nebraska. It's a nice. Ton of stuff that's only available there. So.
Cool.
So that was really fun. And it was pretty inexpensive, really. So I was pretty pleased. It was a good time. Yep. So let's get back on track and begin our discussion of the 1975 film Rollerball.
Champion plays on. You know how the game serves us. It has a definite social purpose. Nations are bankrupt, gone. No poverty, no sickness. Man has accomplished what he'd always craved. Corporate society was an inevitable destiny. A good life, a centuries-old dream.
You better do as you're told, Jonathan. That's all I have to say.
Don't be here when I come back.
You won't be back, Johnny Boy.
No player is greater than the game itself. It's not a game a man is supposed to grow strong in, Jonathan.
Still don't understand why I came.
You're the only person I ever wanted. Wanted you on my side. That's all.
The books you've ordered are classified and have been transcribed and summarized.
Well, who summarizes them?
Zero, of course. He's the world's brain.
Does it answer you?
Well, it speaks.
Mm-hmm. I'd like some information about corporate decisions, how they're made and who makes them.
They're afraid of you, Jonathan. All the way to the top, they are.
The game was created to demonstrate the futility of individual effort. The game do its work.
The game! This wasn't meant to be a game!
And the IMDb plot synopsis goes like this. The year is 2018. There is no crime and there are no more wars. Corporations are now the leaders of the world, as well as the controllers of the people. A violent futuristic game known as Rollerball is now the recreational sport of the world, with teams representing various areas competing for the title of champion. The defending championship team, the Houston team, led by the determined 10-year veteran Jonathan E., is looking to repeat as champions. However, Bartholomew, the sinister corporate head, wants Jonathan to retire, even though he is the most respected athlete of his time. Jonathan's rebellious quest will not come without complications. For both him and his teammates, after he decides to continue playing despite Bartholomew's threats. So, This is, of course, we should say, the 1975 version.
Not... Yes. Yeah. There is only one version of this movie.
Not the LL Cool J vehicle.
No, which I think I had read still has a Rotten Tomatoes freshness score of 3%, I think. Not well received by critics nor the general public. I won't watch it. Rollerball is one of my all time favorite movies, and it is perfect in what it does and how it does it. And I knew that they would just destroy a remake. That there was no way that I was going to watch that.
Yeah, it's interesting because on that sort of in that sort of area of the film, I guess, the whole remake and what this film is saying and all that, I was always aware of this film, and I was certainly aware that there was this version that was more well thought of than the remake, but I had yet to see this film.
Oh, good.
Before this. And, when you had suggested to me, I was like, I'm pretty sure Chris is being serious, but, I was like, is that something I'm going to have that we're going to be able to talk about? Cause I didn't really know a lot about it. Mm-hmm. And then, immediately when I start looking up things about it and realizing that it's more of a social commentary than it is an actual sports film, it's not Major League.
It's not The Longest Yard. It is, which is a great movie,
but another terrible remake.
And another terrible remake. It is my, You've known me long enough that my love of 70s dystopian films.
Sure.
And this is very, very high on the list, of the best in my opinion. That era, that decade, they put out some really amazing films, stuff that would never get made today. Or if it did get made today, it would be like the remake of Rollerball, which is, that whole subset of films from that era is just fantastic. And it's rare to see good dystopian films made today, except with young adult films. Cause you look at all the stuff that's coming out, the Hunger Games and the Maze Runner and, Divergent and all that. Every one of those movies is a dystopian film that really draws from what was going on in the 70s with those films. It's actually kind of cool to see that dystopian films are alive and well. They're just kind of being hidden in these young adult novels and now young adult movies.
Yeah, they are so much more glossy and pretty, and while they may be set in a dystopia, it doesn't, like, nobody actually seems like they're having that rough of a time compared to a film like this.
Yeah, yeah.
You know,
yeah,
I guess the one exception.
Everyone's pretty.
Yeah, the one exception, I guess, would be, and we talked about this a little while ago on one of the themed shows, was The Road.
Oh, yeah.
Where that is very definitely going for the jugular for this is a dystopia, you know.
Yeah, that's not a feel good movie. McCarthy.
Yes.
Snowpiercer was kind of an interesting, have you had a chance to see
that? No, you know, I'm very excited to see that it finally came on Netflix, or not finally, but it did come on.
Yep,
Netflix, check it out. Instance. So I'm looking forward to that for sure.
Well, obviously I love this movie, but I'm really interested just on your overall impression. Did you like Rollerball?
Rollerball. So here's the thing with Rollerball. I loved it.
Awesome.
I was a little apprehensive, and there's, you know, a couple of these notes were specifically for you. Like the first thing that I have written down here is I fucking hate the font that they use in the film.
Yeah, it's 1975, man. It's like saying I hate brown and orange. You're going to get a lot of it, man. It's the 70s. Oh,
and I see this font and I'm like, oh, God, I don't like it. You know, yeah. And obviously that's such a tiny thing. But, you know, even with the number, the way that the numbers are designed.
It's like, futuristic lettering, man.
I know.
That's what letters are going to look like in the future.
It's like impact lettering or something. Oh, it's
yeah. It's just like that total like, digital. Yeah, it's typographically, yeah, rough, but yeah, you know, that's what they were in 1975. I'm sure that's kind of what people imagine the year 2018, you know, being like.
Oh, sure. But yeah, I really did enjoy it just overall. And I thought that it did have some very interesting, social commentaries that were in there. And, you know, I liked that it was a film that knew exactly what it was and was not trying to be overly highbrow in its social commentary. You know, it wasn't trying to hide it.
No, it's right there.
Yeah, it's like, look, here's what we're saying.
Yeah. And, I mean, it's really out there, though. Just the idea that at some point in our future, we could be ruled by corporations and all of our individual interests are suppressed for the greater good of the very few remaining corporations that have taken over the world and done away with government. It's
sure.
Just out there, isn't it?
Yeah, just so.
Or so fucking eerily similar to what, you know, what is happening now. It's, yeah, it's absolutely frightening.
Yeah, we were not too long ago on a show that was released not too long ago from this recording. My girlfriend and I discussed the film Fed Up, which is a film about Big Sugar.
Oh, yeah.
About how Big Sugar is so much more powerful than Big Tobacco ever hoped to be. And, mm-hmm. and just like, and it, a lot of it was the struggle of the First Lady and her attempt to get rid of, or at least make some headway in the battle against obesity.
How dare she?
Yeah. And it was just so interesting to see the way that she was forced to sort of backtrack from every sort of statement that she would make. And it was, you know, she was being pushed to make it be more about exercise and less about nutrition. Yeah. And, you know, we came away from that going, oh my God. You know, and where are we going as a society? And it makes me, you know, sickened to watch a film like that. And then it makes me also a little sick to my stomach watching a film like this where it makes me think, oh, we are not far.
Well, you know, corporations are people now, and mm-hmm. You know, it was really prophetic. And this, you know, this film's almost 40 years old now, but you see how, you know, these cities are, you know, for anyone out there that's listening to this that hasn't watched it, that basically corporations have been combined into giant global monopolies, and there is one corporation that handles energy, and that right. is the one that Jonathan E. plays rollerball for. That's the Houston Corporation. And all the corporations, they're, it's not like, you know, Enron or Halliburton or, you know, whatever. It's, they're all named after cities. So it's the Houston Corporation and it's the Tokyo Corporation and Madrid and New York. And what they run transportation, energy, luxury, housing, communication and food mm-hmm. So those are all of the corporations in the world have been boiled down into one corporation that is in charge of all of those things, mm-hmm. you know, or one of those things. And, you know, how they, this is kind of the weird thing, you know, you look at our culture now, and what the corporations learned and how they keep the masses, sedate and in line is through this game of rollerball. And you look at, you know, the NFL in this country, mm-hmm, mm-hmm. or if you look at soccer, football,
rugby, hockey.
Yeah. You know, I was lucky enough to take a brief trip across the pond this year. To Scotland and even Scotland, which is not an overly populous country. It's not very dense, but, the people there are just ate up with soccer. It is just, you could tell that is what people follow. It's what they talk about. And it is in this world, in the rollerball world, not too far off, it is kind of used to keep people from paying attention to the rest of the world around them.
Yeah, and I love the fact that they want Jonathan to retire. They're forcing a retirement upon him because he's becoming too much of an individual.
Yeah. What's the old adage is the, you know, no player is bigger than the game.
Yes.
And Jonathan is threatening that. He is becoming, he's the Michael Jordan of rollerball, and that game is, through its absolute brutality, is not designed for longevity, and he's been around a little too long. And you know, this is the common theme in all of these 70s dystopian films is the destruction of the individual. You know, mm-hmm. you had like, you know, two kinds of movies. You had like the post-apocalyptic, or you had the quote unquote utopian, now dystopian society. And in the dystopian movies, or the where it's supposed to be the perfect society, it always comes at the cost of individualism. Mm-hmm. And Jonathan is too much of an individual for the corporation.
Sure.
What did you think of Mr. Bartholomew?
Well, I mean, I thought the character was, you know, a terrible person, but I thought that I thought that the acting was very well done. I thought Houseman's
was awesome.
Wonderful.
Yeah, he's always brilliant. But you know, he's the face of the corporation.
Well, okay, see, I guess I could see where you're going with that up until uh-huh. he is sort of pushing the board to go along with him.
Yeah, yeah.
And so I was like, okay, well, maybe he's just the mouthpiece. But then when he's doing the urging, I'm like, I don't know if there's enough there for me to go along with. He's not fully behind this.
Yeah, you know, he's a horrible human being. Uh-huh. But you look at it and it's just like, he definitely has this sense of that's the cost of doing business, mm. you know?
Sure.
And it's just, that's the world they live in, and they maintain this order in the, I mean, it's actually, you know, you look at the world, there's no war, there's no poverty, all of that's been done away with. And so there is this sense that they're maintaining order through this game, and it's for a greater good. Now, I mean, we look at it, you know, from our perspective and say, well, that's horrible. For the cost that they have to pay, you know, for this, you know, crimeless and warless society. But from his perspective, yeah, I'm sure he thinks that he's very much a good guy, which is, you know, what makes the best villain.
Sure. It's the eggs and the omelet, right? It's, mm-hmm. it's at what cost? Because you know, I see this and I think of the films that have, some aspects of this or, you know, some different science fiction or horror films that have some sort of similarity. And you think of, The Terrible, The Island by Michael Bay.
Oh.
you think of The Purge.
Yeah.
You know, you think of films like that where everything is fine except for.
Oh, you know? Sure. Well, what's one of the great ones? The Stepford Wives.
Oh, sure. Exactly.
You know, that's a perfect example.
God, you love some shitty remake movies. Love the originals.
Uh-huh.
Forget about the remakes.
Gattaca is.
Yes, Gattaca is a good one.
That's one. It's, you know, obviously the society they live in is, you know, on the surface is perfect.
You know, with Gattaca, that's almost too antiseptic for me.
Like, it's very clean.
Yeah. It's like, I understand that's the point, but I don't know. That's not an interesting watch as much, I guess.
I liked it, but yeah, I know exactly. And that, I think you're right that they were going for this absolutely, just sterile environment because mm-hmm. everything in the movie was supposed to be that way.
Sure. So, you know what I didn't ask you was how did you come across this? When did you first, check Rollerball out?
Oh, it was
when or is I was it just one that's just always been around?
No, it's actually, I can trace it back almost to the year. It was probably about 97 or so that I watched it. It was, I was living in St. Louis and a friend of mine, I had watched another, may have been like A Boy and His Dog. And we were talking about dystopian films and he's just like, oh, and he starts talking about Rollerball, assuming that I had seen it. I was like, I've never seen that. And he's like, oh, you have to watch Rollerball. Now this is in a pre-Netflix and, you know, era, you know, like internet being all that in a bag of chips. So you had to, you know, I actually had to like go to a movie store.
Oh, the archaic notion of having to go and track it down, right?
I had to rent it. Maybe even on VHS. Now it was, I'm sure it was DVD, but, yeah, it was, not as easy to come by and not really a well, sought after film. But, I think you were saying it's not available on Netflix now.
No, it's not available on Netflix's, DVDs. Service either. Yeah.
Oh, that's funny. It's, Amazon has it too.
Right. Yeah. Amazon is where I ended up getting it.
Yep. You spent the whole $3, huh?
Yep. I couldn't go the $3.99 and go for the HD, but I did do the $2.99. So.
It's 1975. It doesn't.
Yeah, I figured that's what, you know, that's exactly what I thought. I was like, well, there is a Blu-ray that's very hard to get and mm-hmm. very expensive.
Really?
That's out for this. It was a very limited release.
Oh, interesting.
And it's going on Amazon for over $50.
Oh, Jesus.
And I was like, wow, that's definitely not what I'm going to do. But, you know, you would think with it being a 40-year anniversary next year,
mm-hmm.
I think it's probably about time for them to come out with a proper wide market release on that.
Absolutely.
I would imagine. Absolutely. What, you know, one of the things that I wanted to mention, that's a little bit of a director thing is I love the way that it opens. And I think in a sport-based film, well, in a way, I mean, it's social commentary mostly, but with sport taking a big part of the film, I thought it was interesting that it didn't open in the middle of action, but it opened in the anticipation of action.
Yeah, the setup.
Yeah, and I thought that was really interesting because it's like you were introduced to this roller derby, hockey, football sport. Mm-hmm. And you weren't exactly sure what was going to happen, but once you saw them come out and they've got, spikes on their gloves and helmets, and you're like, holy shit, like something...
it's getting ready to go down.
Yeah, like something's going to happen, and I thought that was such a smart way to open the film, because I think I had the initial reaction of what a lot of people that were probably too young to see this when they first saw it had, where it was like, oh yeah, cool, look at this. Oh, they're beating the shit out of each other. And then it would get, it gets farther into these, I think there's what, three main set pieces with the roller rink.
Yeah, there's three.
And
yeah,
there's three. It gets towards the end of that first one, and I'm like, oh no, like, ooh, wow, this is really getting intense. Like, this is really getting violent.
Oh, they're great. I mean, they're great scenes. I mean, it's just very action packed, very kinetic. It's, I was talking with a friend about these scenes, and we were saying, you know, who would do the best as an artist if this were to be translated to a comic book? And I was like, oh, Gene Colan. Without a doubt, because Colan loved scenes like that. He even talked several times about how the movie Bullet, the car chase scene,
yes,
just changed the way that he wanted to draw comics, and it drove Stan Lee crazy. But so there's your comic book talk for the evening. But the just really kinetic scenes, and you know, you're spot on with the introduction and why, you know, my guess as to why it didn't start in the middle of a game, which would have been the easy thing to do.
Sure.
Is that it really showed the production that this, it starts off showing you that this isn't about rollerball. It's not about the games. It's about the production of putting these on and the theater of it. And, you know, that they're doing this as entertainment. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it's one of the things I love about Jonathan in the movie is that, you know, he loves the sport. You see that in the first game, and he even comments on it.
Yeah, he has the line that says that. I think it, even in the middle, mm-hmm, in the middle game. Yeah.
He loves this game, and he's good at it. He's not just good at it, he's the best at it. And it's not just because he's physically superior. He has a true love for the game. I mean, he's he just absolutely loves it. And then to come to the realization that he is, for the large part, a tool, mm-hmm, for the corporations to use to keep the population kind of sedated. I think as he starts to realize this, you know, it had to be just an amazing struggle for that character to, you know, to come to grips with that.
Sure, yeah. I mean, he is the instrument of their release.
Mm-hmm.
Is what it had, you know, and it's, I mean, that's very much a, you know, like a gladiator sort of thing.
Mm-hmm.
You know, where it's the crowd's getting off on it. And I think what's interesting is I think it's also really smart that at the beginning they're cheering and they're having fun, the crowd.
Mm-hmm.
But it seems like a sporting event. You know, it doesn't seem anything out of the norm.
Yeah.
By the time the finals and the no rules, no time, I mean, it's a
the bloodbath.
Oh, it's a savage wasteland in the crowd. There's people coming onto the feet, onto the rink. Mm-hmm. There's, you know, some of the corporation people are even up in arms and screaming and yelling, and it was just everyone had gone savage at that point.
Yeah.
And well, it was like, oh my God, like even the, you know, at this point, even the fans were at the boiling point, you know?
It's definitely a Sodom and Gomorrah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, and you see that earlier in the film at the party where
I did want to make sure and mention this. Yes.
Yeah. What did you think about that scene?
Okay. What's interesting is I loved the fact that nobody bothered or wanted to talk to him, but they would watch his highlights all night long.
Yes.
I loved that because it's like, here is the man.
He's right there.
And I think, you know, James Caan, who in this area of his life was great.
Oh, yeah.
I think when I think of him now, he's played such odd characters and made such poor choices.
Yeah,
and
there's some out there.
Yeah, and it reminds me to, you know, when I watch this or Godfather, you know, something like that, I'm like, oh, my God, yeah, he is very good and just has made some really poor choices, which I'm hoping is paycheck based or something.
Probably, yeah. Yeah, you know? It's him and Gene Hackman.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, we talked to Cameron Rice and I that do filmographies. We talked to Gabe Hardman about the French Connection. Where we're going through we're going through William Friedkin's filmography.
So
we had Gabe on to talk Sorcerer, The French Connection, and The Exorcist.
Nice.
And so that was good. And listening to Gabe talk about those actors in that time was a really good time.
That dude's so smart. I can talk about why I liked a movie and different things I pull from it. That dude is a first of all, he's in the industry, but he's an encyclopedia and just knows the craft so well.
Yeah, it's you got to do your homework.
Oh, yeah, because
he will let you know if you don't know what you're talking about.
Yes, he will.
So I was very prepared. I was ready.
Nice.
And
nice.
I was qualifying things. So, you know, you get the hang of it after a while. After a couple talks where you're like, holy shit, I needed to do it better.
Oh, no, I didn't study enough.
Yeah.
So how do you like the blowing up trees?
Okay, yeah, scene? The party, the shooting the trees. I put it was a display of just the filth of human nature to me. Mm-hmm. Yep. Because it was so, you know, they were drunk and just being complete assholes, right?
Yes.
And
yes.
I loved that it was like, holy shit, you know, when they were reacting like that after they were blowing up trees and almost shooting each other, and there was just no sense of consequence, and there was just, you know, the added little bit of the almost Tolkien-esque of just destroying nature. And, you know, I just loved that they just couldn't care less about anything other than themselves and this one chance that they kind of got to break free and do whatever they wanted to.
Yep. And just sit back and watch it burn. Mm-hmm. And that's, you know, that's the state of the world. And I think that for Jonathan, you know, it's not that he was there to witness that, but I think there is this realization of these are the people that I'm doing this for, you know, and he's getting jerked around so bad at that point in the movie that you really, I think just about that point, you start to feel like he is the last redeemable person in the world. I mean, there's no one else that at that point, cause you know, his friends, you know, his best friend is a vegetable now. And,
yeah. That was after Moon Pie, right?
After Moon Pie. Yeah. And so he's at that point, he's kind of the last person that is worth rooting for, you know, even his ex-wife. That was before the ex-wife.
Yes.
Yes. You know, but there really is no one in the movie worth rooting for other than him, you know, at the end.
Yeah, you know what I did like? It says team executive. I liked essentially the coach.
Yeah.
And he seemed like a smart guy. Like, he seemed like he knew what the score was, you know?
Yes, yeah.
And I liked that he was in there so little, though.
Yeah.
You know? I mean, you see him in bits, and he's always kind of got the, you know, he knows what the deal is. So it's like, all right, get it back out there, get them out of here, you know, and all that. But he does have a few lines in there that makes you think, this guy's just, he's, you know, a cog in the machine, but he's at least aware of it.
Yeah. Well, and it's really funny that he's not a coach. Because a coach is an individual position. He's the team executive.
Right. Yeah, that's, you know, a good point. Yeah.
That's, and very consciously, I bet that they did that.
So. Yeah, so, okay, let me talk about the ex-wife. Now, she was removed from him?
Yeah, she was just like
it was like an assignment, correct?
Well, no, it was his wife.
Okay.
Well, there was the concubine
right.
that left after like 6 months, the brunette. Right. And then he got the new concubine, the company supplied concubine. Well, he was married before, but she was awarded to, I think is how they.
Yes. Okay.
She basically was bought and sold by the corporation to an executive. And, you know, you get the feeling that may have been done to keep Jonathan in his place.
Hmm. Sure.
And because they continue to use that as leverage against him later.
Mm-hmm.
But it also, you know, it also shows that, you know, in this world, people are bought and sold. I mean, we've not only given up our individuality to the corporations, we've actually given up your civil rights and personal freedoms. People are property to be mm-hmm. bought and sold.
Yeah. Yeah. I think that, you know, with that whole storyline, I think that Jonathan E., who, as you mentioned, is this kind of macho star at this, you know, this death game, he has a tremendous sense of range with his emotions, though. And I think what James Caan does is what's so effective about it is he plays hurt and he plays sad without crying and moping and being very overt about mm-hmm. it. Mm-hmm. But you could see a still of the film and be like, oh man, he's having a rough go. But yeah. it's not, you know, he doesn't go to Moon Pie and start bawling his eyes out or something. You know?
No, it's, I mean, he's a stoic character, and, you know, he understands the brutality of the game. You know, in the world that they live in, it's just, that's what they do.
Yeah. I just like a film that chooses to have stoic characters, because I think that the mm-hmm. irritation for me is everyone is so verbal in films because they kind of have to be, you know, whether it's a quiet character, but they have a narration or someone else is speaking and telling the stoic character their emotions. I'm just glad that, you know, he doesn't talk a lot.
No.
I mean, he speaks. It's not like he's a mute or something, but I'm just glad that he's not, well, I'm feeling this.
Yeah.
And I, you know, I'm just glad that he doesn't do that. And I think that more modern films do this more than films of this time, to where everyone speaks all the time. But I think, my go-to example of someone that does not do that is Tom Hardy in his films. And I think what Tom Hardy does is he has a rare thing where he can look and you know that he's intelligent without having him speak, but he also can play a physical presence. And I'm not speaking of The Dark Knight Rises. I'm talking of Warrior, which is a film that I really, really enjoy. And he is an MMA guy for people that, you know, haven't seen the film. I believe a Marine or an army, and he, joins the MMA, and it's a kind of like a more classic, sports movie, and it kind of goes where you think, but he's a guy that just doesn't talk a lot. And he's kind of a guy that, you know, isn't real smart, but mm-hmm. has more going on than people think. And mm-hmm. so he always holds back a little bit. And I just think that he plays it so well. And it's a guy where when I see this, if this had to have been remade and it wasn't already attempted, it would be
that would be the guy. Okay.
That would be the guy.
Yeah. It's never going to get remade again.
Right.
It's not going to happen.
I also have a thing where every older movie I see, I'm like, oh man, Tom Hardy would be good in this. I may have a problem.
Well, from this era, it's one of the things I love about not just the 70s dystopian films, but 70s films in general, is that they were given air to breathe. Mm-hmm. Not every scene has to be packed with dialogue and action. You don't see slow camera pans anymore. And that's kind of a staple of a lot of these movies. I mean, you look at, Planet of the Apes.
Oh, sure.
There are scenes that are minutes long of just panning the landscape. And you're just like, wow, they don't take time to do that in movies anymore. They don't allow a lot of actors to have presence. Mm-hmm. You know, they can't just stand there and have presence. So
yeah, I just like the idea of a film, and it comes off to me as having confidence in the material or the performances, and just mm-hmm. allowing the audience to feel relaxed. You know, it's mm-hmm. just settle in, it's fine, because this film has moments like that too, where there's not a lot going on in mm-hmm. bits. And I mean, I really like that, because it makes, when it is more of an amplified scene, it makes that, you know, even higher, even more heightened,
mm-hmm.
because you are allowed to rest and to relax and learn about, you know, this guy's life, and the way that it's shot is in a slower, more relaxed way. And I know that the whole critique now is that, oh, you know, because of Michael Bay, he's, you know, birthed this whole quick cutting, but it's not just him. I mean, every film I see is just in such a hurry
yep.
to do nothing.
Yep. Yep.
And that's
yep.
what bothers me. It's like the films are so long, but the scenes are so short, and they're in such a hurry to tell so much story, but there's just not enough story there. It's just a whole thing.
Yeah, I mean, and there are still good independent films that take their time. One of the last ones that I can remember, it's like, wow, they actually kind of harken back to that. 28 Days Later.
Actually, that's a great movie.
It took its time yeah. where it needed to, and you just don't see that nearly enough. But yeah,
They can't overdo it. I wouldn't say that it necessarily I'm a fan, but I am aware and have watched all of Kelly Reichardt's films, and she is a female director that works mm-hmm. a lot with Michelle Williams.
Okay.
And I'm a big Michelle Williams fan, and they did a film called Meek's Cutoff a few years ago.
Mm-hmm.
And that is a very, very deliberate film.
Yeah. Well, it's like, what is it, Gus Van Sant? Is that?
Yeah, is like that. Very, yeah. very languid.
Well, yeah, there's a point where, you know, you can meander.
Yes.
So, yeah. yeah. You know, but this film, you know, Rollerball has enough air to breathe. You know, you're talking about the coach or the mm-hmm. team executive. You know, it's like, we could have gotten his whole backstory. They could have had, you know, a scene with he and Jonathan, you know, more than the very small scene that we got with them. You know, they could have gone more into that character and what motivated him and what role did he play. They didn't fucking need to.
Right.
And so they didn't. And I love that. You got what you needed from the cast of characters in this, and you didn't get stuff that you didn't need. And that's one of I love the economy of storytelling, you know, in this and other movies from that era.
Yeah. I think a lot of what goes hand in hand with that is that the filmmakers realize that this is not about the sport.
Mm-hmm.
So you don't have to know why, I guess his name is Rusty. You don't have to know why Rusty has his viewpoint.
Yeah.
He just does, and that's fine. You know? Let me ask you this. What do you think of the scene where, you know, if you want to compare this in the United States to it being football, mm-hmm. Which is a little touchy, especially now, but what do you think of the scene where Jonathan gets a little rough and scratches up his new lady a bit?
That scene, that's intro, because, yeah, I don't know exactly how to phrase this.
Mm-hmm. I was going to say, because I have, Like I have something written down and I want to make sure I say it the right way.
Yeah, you know, it's, you know, obviously, you know, physical violence against women, bad, period. You know, but that was the new concubine, right? Daphne?
Mm-hmm. Sure. Yes.
Yeah. You know, and that was, you know, she was an agent of the corporation.
Right. I think that's seen threatening him at this point.
That's kind of the important part of that scene is that, you know, he knows that he can't trust anyone mm-hmm. now and that the corporation will do anything they can to just short of killing him, even though he decides not to take a little helicopter ride.
Right. Yes.
So that's where he kind of came to the realization of how serious they were. And so, yeah, kind of roughing up the concubine. Mm-hmm. Yeah, you know, certainly the motivation was there. You know, understand why. I mean, she was basically threatening his life.
Yeah, I put that. You know, it's kind of it's an unfortunate bit of violence against women.
Mm-hmm.
But I think that it has to be there.
Yeah,
and I think that it shows that he knows what's going on. That he's, you know, aware that he is on his own. There were times in the film around this area where I was like, well, is Moonpie against him? Because there's some like knowing looks before the Tokyo match.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there's the guy that's riding the bike that kind of has a couple of looks. And so I'm like, what's going on? Like these guys are looking over at the Asian team. I'm not sure if that is a, you know, one of us is going to die look, or if it's a, oh yeah, we're going to get Jonathan E kind of look, because, you know, as a first watch, I was like, I don't know what the hell's going to happen.
Yeah.
And,
yeah.
And what
that's a 70s film. So you don't know.
That's exactly what I was going to say.
They could kill him and like, you know, it's.
Yeah. That's exactly what I was going to say. It's the 70s. So everyone could die. I don't.
Anything can happen.
Yeah. But I think that it also goes to show that James Caan is not, well, Jonathan E is not a perfect man by any means either.
No.
Like exactly. He is breaking and so he does use that bit of violence against a woman mm-hmm. as opposed to restraining himself as, you know, as you should. So,
you know, it's Moonpie is an interesting character because he is, as you see Jonathan E kind of mature through the movie and realize what's going on and the role that they play with the game. They start off as their best friends and they start off being very much of the same mind. As the movie moves on, I think there is that sense that Moonpie is like, you know, hey brother, don't upset the apple cart. We've got it pretty good here. You know, the corporation takes care of us. They give us anything we want. Why are you questioning this stuff? Just go, you know, you can retire and they'll take care of you for the rest of your life. Why are you doing this? You know, he doesn't come out and say that, but you see every bit of that in that character, that he loves playing the game and he loves being taken care of by the corporation. If the roles were reversed and Moonpie is the 10-year veteran and the greatest player on the planet, I think the corporation comes to him and says, hey, you know, here's a sweet ranch and you get, you know, hookers, different hooker every day, and you never have to work again. Moonpie takes that deal.
Absolutely, it does, yeah. Mm-hmm. What I loved about that, too, is it seemed like he was in the position of being the next Jonathan E.
Yes.
You know, yes. He was the young up-and-comer. We need to put this old guy out to pasture, and he is the sort of corporate drone that we're looking for.
Mm-hmm.
And yep. So I think that that's an interesting, it's like, okay, well, we're on the field and we're together and we're buddies, but our philosophies are much different.
Yep.
You know, yep. It's a little bit like, it's a little bit like when 11 o'clock comics would talk politics.
Yes. On those unfortunate times that would happen.
So it'd be like, look, you're my buddies. Yes. I don't necessarily agree with you.
Your political views are completely wrong, but sure. You are still my friend.
Right. So I can see a little bit of that with the camaraderie between the two of those characters there.
Yeah.
You know, I thought,
well, they're like war buddies, mm-hmm. you know, that's, you know, this is a replacement for war in the society. So they are very much that they're like battalion brothers. You know, they're war buddies.
Mm-hmm. And one of the other things that I thought was really well handled was his death, Moon Pie.
Mm-hmm.
I liked that there was restraint in that he's essentially held up and then hit in the back of the head with a spiked glove.
Mm-hmm.
But I think that if that is shot now, there's a spurt of blood.
Oh, yeah.
There's, you know, a big mess made. And I think that what's nice about it is the point is he, at the end of the day, is just another player. And mm-hmm. while he was set up to be the next Jonathan E., he goes down and look, guess what? We'll have another one tomorrow.
Yep.
And there's people
waiting in line.
Yeah, he's just another guy. And we don't need to show this elaborate death. We don't need to try to shock you with the blood because it doesn't matter. Because it just doesn't matter. And I think that was really well done. I did have in here, Neesman, that I was unprepared for the brutality.
Yeah.
You know, I as the film kept going, I was, and I think it was the Asian match, the middle one.
Yeah, the Tokyo.
And with Moon Pie's death, and I was like, oh my god. Like, I can't, like, holy it's shit.
Brutal, man.
Yeah, because yeah. It was pushing to the point of, I was waiting for it to be like a scene out of like Strange Brew or like a Mel Brooks film or something, you know, because it was like so ridiculous
mm-hmm.
to where yeah. it just teetered on the line of not going to be too ridiculous. Like if there would have been limbs lost and that sort of thing, it would have been too much. But it's still sided on the side of realism, and it
ratchets up every game, and that's mm-hmm. part of the corporation's plan is to force Jonathan to retire by making the game more and more violent. And you know, it's not just for him, but it's for his teammates. And you know, and if you look at it, he's kind of responsible for Moon Pie's death.
Yeah.
And you see that guilt and that the moment of you know, compassion where he just, you know, he's not going to pull the plug on him. And you know, I thought that was a really nice scene as well. You know, it just, you needed to humanize Jonathan E. one last time before they go into the ultimate, you know, death match at the end.
Right. Now let me ask you about the computer sequence.
Mm-hmm.
First of all, I love movies that have computers in them from the 70s.
yeah, because it's all the same computer.
It's the same computer. I love how, you know, in the 80s, the computers can do anything.
Mm-hmm.
In the 70s, there's these rooms full of computers that there's no real rule as to what they can and can't do.
Yeah, it's just a big talking box.
Yeah, and so I was interested in this sequence because they mentioned that they lost the 13th century. And they mm-hmm. keep mentioning it. Like they say it a couple of times. And I was like, well, I wonder why that specific reference. You know, like I wonder why 13. Is that just a number that they picked? Is that something that's in the source material maybe that is explained more specifically? I just felt like the film mm-hmm. had so much commentary in it that wasn't a random insert.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
But I didn't take the time to look up why exactly it was the 13th century. But I'm sure that there's something in there that, you know, made him choose that.
Yeah, I'm gonna have to research because this is based on it's a written piece and
yes.
it's a short story
I believe.
Okay,
yes.
Which I'm gonna have to track down. But you know, it's a fully realized world, but they don't take you on a history lesson. Mm-hmm. I mean, you know that there was a corporate war and that, you know, before that things were bad and the corporate wars were horrible, but you know, they came out of it into this, you know, new era of peace and control. So, you know, I'm always like a movie that, just allows you to drop into a world and you pick up bits and pieces of it.
Yeah. So. Oh yeah. Same thing with any kind of story. You just get put in midway and you have to figure it out. Yep. You have to
I'll figure it out. Yep. Exactly.
Yeah. That's what was great about starting reading comics, right? It was just, you just start whenever you start.
Yep.
And you figure it out. I did think, you know, and so for me, the only part that I didn't really love was this computer sequence. And that was with Zero and the not answering questions. And I'm like, okay, that's an interesting idea that he's not able to get the answers that he wants specifically. Mm-hmm. But what does it bring to the overall film? You know, this section I don't know about.
I think that was the point, is that he was asking questions that he was not ever going to get the answer for. Mm-hmm. That the level of corporate control was so ingrained at that point that he was never gonna find out who was in charge.
Just futile exercise.
Yeah, it's like, you know, Mr. Bartholomew, it's like, yeah, in charge, but not really. Sure. You know, he wasn't all the way up he wasn't the top of the food chain. Mm-hmm. And Jonathan was never going to find out who was really in control.
Mm. I like that. Yeah. I guess that's one of the victims of watching it for the first time, I think.
Yeah.
I think
yeah.
I watched it again. I'm like, oh, okay. Well, that's evident. One of the other director choices, one of the last ones here, once we get towards the last section of the film, is I love the fact that the final battle, the final game, mm-hmm. has the red lights as they come out. It's the exiting hell, entering hell. You know, it has that motif.
Yeah.
Right?
Where they just like turn them off.
I just think that's such a simple thing. Just have them coming out of a smoky red room. You know, this tunnel is red. And it instantly brings upon that thought, right?
Oh, yeah, yeah. And it looks awesome.
Yes, it does. It looks very cool.
Yeah, it was an awesome-looking scene.
You know, the other thing that I thought was really interesting about this whole final death match, and, mm-hmm. You know, we have just people going down left and right, and I was watching it, and it's when, you know, they're getting down to it, and there's three of them left, and it was at that point when I realized that there was not a score.
Yeah.
And I was like, wow. I was like, I really like that. Because I feel like for me, I would tend to think in the 70s, watching a film, it would be trying to force me to feel a certain way. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And I like the fact that, you know, the director doesn't do that, which is a little bit of a commentary on the film itself. You know, the corporations are trying to make you do everything that you do. Mm-hmm. And here, I think it would be easy for the director to try to make you feel a certain way, but he doesn't. He just trusts the film and the subject matter and the scene of Jonathan E. deciding not to kill the final player, and, you know, to score and kind of prove his final point and. You know, I just thought that was a great, great ending. I really, really liked that.
Okay, so, and that's not an ending that you're gonna see in other movies. They don't leave him, you know, it's like, well, what happens to him? You know, what happens after the game? Does he go back to the ranch? Do they kill him? Whatever. You don't need to know. It doesn't matter.
Yeah, but I think that that's what is so great about it, because I think that what it does is, it allows you to talk about the film. It allows you to, mm-hmm. you know, say we went and saw the film for the first time together. It allows you to drive home and talk about it.
Yeah. You know what happens to him after the last scene? You know, it's, you don't know, but you know, you can speculate.
Yeah. You can definitely have a good idea that he's probably not going to survive.
Exactly. It's, you know, but he's also, you know, he may be too big to become a martyr. Now, you know, it's like, yeah, he'll become a martyr.
Yeah.
And, you know, so yeah, it's, you know, I do love that it just, it ends. And it ends with the, you know, the huge blow up of his face.
Yeah, and not a clear picture either.
No.
And so it
no.
made me think, like, is this the stunt double? Because this, you know, in film history, this is the first film to list stunt doubles.
Oh, wow. Okay.
And so they all get listed after this point because the director thought they did such a good job that they should be listed.
An important part of the movie, for sure.
Cast. Oh, sure. And so I think that, you know, it's important because in the story of the film, it's the man who finally became bigger than the game.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you hear all of these, I would guarantee you hear it in the next week or two between college football and pro football, you know, about getting an unsportsmanlike conduct penalty for a celebration or something and trying to be bigger than the game,
yep. right?
Trying to draw too much attention to yourself.
Well, it's funny. It's, you know, there are two chants in the movie. There's the one whenever the guy comes in and is trying to, you know, teach the team how to play against the Tokyo team, and they're karate. And they start chanting, you know, Houston, 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 you know, about, and the team and how, you know, they're Houston and they're not going to lose. And, you know, then the end of the movie, you get the Jonathan chant and, you know, he's transcended the team and the sport, mostly because the rest of the team's dead now, but,
you're running out of guys to choose.
He's running out of guys to cheer for. But, you know, it's, that is that chant. And, you know, and you see the Houseman character is darting out of the stadium because he has come to the realization that whatever Rollerball was, to the corporations, that's gone now. Right. And it showed how, I think, how desperate that society was for a hero to root for.
Sure. It's that struggle for individualism and for control.
Yep.
You know, it's that ongoing struggle. And that's why it seems like, you know, if I was imagining what I would think would happen, it would be he is on his way to somewhere and is involved in a quote accident.
Yeah.
You know, and then they don't do Rollerball for a couple of years and then have the big return, you know, and it comes back and it's bigger and better than ever. And, you know, it's the same sort of, that just seems like in 2014, that's what they would do, you know?
Yes. Yeah, exactly. Exactly. You know, in our world, it's, people would get over it really quickly. Mm-hmm. I mean, God, you see what football has gone through in this country this year with the, you know, the domestic violence and the child abuse and the, you know, it's a very rapey league.
Oh yeah.
And people still, yeah, I'm guilty of this. I'm a Bears fan, so it's been easy for me to turn off the TV and not
care. I was gonna say to write off pro.
Yeah, it's, yeah, they've made it easy for me to take the moral stand of, I'm not gonna watch that league.
Right.
Now, you know, if I was a Arizona Cardinal fan or a New England fan, it might be different. But, you know, you see just how the appetite for this kind of diversion in our culture. And it was there in 1975, maybe not to the extent that it's shown in Rollerball. And so it is a little prophetic because it shows just, the scene, you know, going back to how they would let scenes breathe a little bit, whenever it's the championship game and they're panning through the streets of the city.
Yes.
And it's completely deserted. Because everyone is inside watching this game. You know, it's like, have you ever gone shopping during the Super Bowl?
Oh, yes.
It's like the best time to go to the grocery store.
You know, that's no shit. I mean, being growing up in Nebraska, you know,
on game day.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. You know, and I was born in the late 70s.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, Nebraska, it was in its peak in the mid 90s.
Mm-hmm.
And so, of course, that hits me when I'm 15 to 18.
Yeah, the Osborne era.
Oh, yeah. And so, you know, now it's a whole mess of, oh, you just, why aren't we any good, blah, blah, blah. And, you know, no one understands about the cycle of sports and about how, you know, you understand this with the Cardinals where you're going to be really, really good sometimes and most of the time you're going to kind of tread water and occasionally you'll sneak up there and you'll have an elite group that you'll try as you know, as hard as you can to keep on and, yeah. and hold
we
on
a,
to.
We have a bad year every once in a while.
Sure, every once in a while. But, you know, and so it is very
it's
much.
It's all consuming, yeah.
Yeah, it's very much like that here in Lincoln, you know, in the capital city where, in Memorial Stadium, you, if there's a game day or anywhere near game day and you want to go do anything, it's a great time to do it if places are open still.
Yeah. You unlike on game day, like Memorial Stadium, that turns into like the third largest town.
Third largest, yeah.
In Nebraska. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah. So. 90 some thousand.
Mm-hmm. Jesus.
You know, and it's, you know, for kids that are 18 to 23, maybe years old. I mean, it is as close to we, as what we have to professional sports.
Mm-hmm. Oh, sure.
You know,
sure.
And they are just tearing apart kids that are not old enough to drink yet.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
it's...
and it's just, you know, this, that, and the other. And going along with the NFL thing, you know, I have people in my Twitter feed that, you know, when Adrian Peterson was taken out of the NFL for child abuse or suspected child abuse, I saw people just losing their mind. About, mm-hmm. He's on my fantasy football. I don't care if he murdered someone. Get him back in there. You know, and I'm like,
it's like no. Like,
oh my God.
No, you horrible person. No.
Yeah. And I'm like, what the hell? Like, I am so far distanced myself. I am so far distanced from the NFL. Mm-hmm. And it wasn't because of some sort of morality. I just, in Nebraska, I've never had a team to root for. Like, you know, I used to cheer for, oh, well, I hope the Chiefs do well. Oh, well, I hope the Broncos do well. But it wasn't like ingrained like it is the Huskers.
Oh, sure. Sure. So,
but yeah. So I can see where people and individuals would get wrapped up in something like rollerball, especially mm-hmm. if that's your only outlet.
Well, it's the only outlet because the corporations, you know, obviously these corporations believe in monopolies because they are all monopolies. And so they've eliminated all other sport.
Mm-hmm.
So like rollerball is, that's it, man. That is the sport.
Yeah. And you can, you can see what happens when people get drunk and, have the luxury of having, you know, enough room and enough booze and some kind of a Star Wars-esque pistol.
Yes.
To blow
yes.
some trees up and shit. So, I mean, I just think that that's so interesting because it's like, I was very much anticipating someone getting shot.
Yeah.
You know, and I was like, oh my God, don't, what are you doing?
You're not someone being up very responsible. What was hilarious is that it was a pistol, but like fired these like rockets. It was like a rocket pistol,
oh, yeah.
which I thought was hilarious.
Yeah.
The inherent violence of man kind of commentary. So absolutely. Cool, man. I'm really glad you liked it.
I was really excited about it. I mean, I was, you know, what's funny is I watched this with my girlfriend and she is, I mean, barely creeping into a sports fan at all. And it's mostly mm-hmm. just through my will of making her watch things.
Yeah.
Right. It's like, you will watch, you are going to learn about baseball and you will love the Braves. Sorry.
Yeah. Or you should apologize.
Yeah. Well, that's what WTBS does to you in the 80s.
Yes, exactly.
It's the lovable loser aspect that turns the corner and, Now they're talking about just shedding as much payroll and as much people as they can to try to make a prospect laden team for 2017 when they move stadiums.
Wouldn't surprise me if Jason Hayward's a Cardinal.
I saw that today as well for a little Carlos Martinez action.
I would be in favor of that.
He's a hell of a right fielder.
Yeah, well, we need one.
So there you go. So, anyway, do you have anything else about rollerball? But
what
I was going to say about Anel is, She's not much of a sports fan.
Mm-hmm.
And so watching this, the sports of it all, she was just kind of like, all right.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know. And so I thought that it plays a little bit better if you're into some kind of a sport.
Yeah. Because they were extended scenes. They were long scenes, the mm-hmm. games. They were like full games almost.
Sure. So she could appreciate it, but it wasn't one that she was going to be, you know, telling friends about and that sort of thing.
Cool. Yeah, it's one of my favorite, you know, 70s dystopian movies, and I've got a list of them, man. So anytime you wanna chat about a 70s dystopian film, just give me a holler and I'll throw one out there. You know, Death Race, Boy and His Dog. It's, you know, the long list of movies.
I mean, Death Race 2000.
Yes, Death Race 2000.
Okay.
Vanishing Point, another good one. So, yeah, there's a ton of them. Hell, I throw Planet of the Apes in there as well.
Mm-hmm.
So just more of the post-apocalyptic, you know, good stuff.
Sure. All right. Well, if people out there have any comments, suggestions, or movies that you'd like to hear us talk about specifically for this show, for Podshots, you could email us at plainlabelpodcast@gmail.com. You could follow the show over at Twitter. Our handle is @plainlabelpod, where you could follow me over there. I am @EricWilliams79. We also have a Facebook page where you could like the show. Just search for Plain Label Podcast. If you wanted to help us out a little bit, you could head over to Amazon.com, and we have a wish list over there. And it's full of movies that we want, equipment that we need, and a whole host of other little goodies. If you're in the giving mood, just search for the wish list called Plain Label Podcast.
So get Eric the Rollerball on Blu-ray.
The $50 one? That would be good. As of recording, I did have a listener give me some goodies, and they got something for the six-year-old, and they got something for my girlfriend, which was booze related, so it was it was very much appreciated.
Outstanding.
Yeah, absolutely. A little copper mug for the Moscow Mules.
Oh, nice. Oh, yeah. Get some ginger beer.
Oh yeah, absolutely. So I do want to thank Chris once again for coming on and discussing the film. If people wanted to hear more from you, they could check out our previous discussions on Payback and Man on Fire. But if they wanted to hear more from you or get in contact with you, where could they find you these days? You're a rare man to find these days.
Curling Club. And I'm only half joking.
That's
true. Yeah, you know, it's Facebook, I guess. I don't really tweet. @CNeesman on Twitter. So yeah, I need to tweet more. But not doing much with the comic books these days. You know, stepped away from that. Still reading, but not talking as much about them. But you know, go check out the guys at 11 o'clock comics. They're still real good friends of mine, and they talk comics every week. So go listen to Vince and David and Jason. And other than that, just good curling.
There you go. So thank you for listening, and we'll be back in 2 weeks with another co-host and another film.